For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. I'm your host, Red Sale.
And I'm Robert Kirkwood. And coming up this week,
Natasha Pulley introduces us to Kato Mori, a clairvoyant samurai and the watchmaker of Filigree Street.
Anthony McGowan gives us his reaction to winning the Sir Carnegie Medal.
And Katerina Diamond takes us through her latest twisty crime thriller, Woman in the Water.
All that plus books of your life coming up in today's Read On.
In her dazzling debut novel, The Watchmaker of Filigree Street, Natasha Pulley introduced us to Kato Mori, a clairvoyant samurai living in Victorian London. Now, Mori is back in The Lost Future of Pepper Harrow, and again he's involved in international intrigue. As the Japanese Empire teeters and the world's great powers itch to get involved for their own strategic advantage, Mori must journey from Moscow to London and then Japan, in a historical adventure that's laced with elements of fantasy.
It's easy to think that nobody could really arrange the world like clockwork. All sorts of things would get stuck in the mechanisms. History is full of queens and generals who've given it a damn good go, but failed because of nothing more complicated than the weather. But clairvoyants have a knack for arranging time, and it was not without a sense of irony that Kato Mori was a watchmaker. In his workshop, it was difficult to see what he was making until it was done. A sort of organized chaos characterized the way he worked, so much so that he could be constructing something for months or years, and it would only look like a tangle of something generically worrying, right up until it got up, walked off, and turned out to be an octopus. It was even harder to tell what he was making when he was using time and not steel. But if you knew him quite well, it was possible to discern when he was arranging something, and sometimes even sketch the shape of its tentacles. One tentacle began to take a clear shape, to anyone watching closely enough, on the last day of October in 1888 in St. Petersburg.
Thomas Judd narrating The Lost Future of Pepper Harrow, written by my guest, Natasha Pulley. Natasha, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Lost Future of Pepper Harrow is another thumpingly good adventure that takes us across the world in a tale of international intrigue.
Thank you. That's the best description I've ever heard of it. That's very pleasing indeed.
And Kato Mori is, well, he's a complex character, isn't he? He can see the future, and to an extent, he can influence how future events take place, but he's not all powerful.
No, he's not all powerful. And I think that was a very diplomatic description you gave of him just now. He is a nutbag, of course he is. So he has this bizarre ability to remember ahead. So he remembers multiple versions of things. So he spends his life just trying to navigate down the path that seems like it will do some good. But his idea of good is often a little bit skewed from other people's idea of good.
And he lives by the samurai code of politeness, deference, but also he definitely feels his own position to make a difference and that his way of seeing things is right.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. He's very caught between those two things. He is trapped between this idea of Japanese chivalry and of being very careful of the people who are weaker than you. And of course, this is the idea of chivalry world over. But he's also very aware that what he can do comes with a responsibility to do something. And one of the things he finds very difficult is to sit and do nothing. But every now and then he does have to do that. So these two things clash with him an awful lot of the time.
And you bring that out by contrasting him with his very close friend, Nathaniel Stapleton, who is a lowly British civil servant working in the Foreign Office and Mori's life companion.
Yeah, definitely. And so the big difference between these two is class. So Mori comes from one of the most powerful samurai houses in Japan. The Mori are a real family, and Nathaniel Stapleton is just this lad from North Lincolnshire, grew up on the banks of the Humber. And so Thaniel kind of stumbles through their friendship with absolutely no idea why Maury bothers with someone like him. Because to Thaniel's mind, he's thinking, well, Maury is this annihilating genius. What does he want with some nobody who's working at the Foreign Office in London? So they are a kind of a marriage of two opposites in some ways, but in others they are identical.
And both of them need to discover things about themselves that actually only somebody who is very similar but from a different background can help you find.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the things that Maury is in it to teach Thaniel is that Thaniel has immense worth because he's a musician and he's actually an incredibly good musician. And just because he's born lowly doesn't mean that he should write that off. One of the things that Maury does through the book, but also through the previous book, is try to nudge Thaniel in the direction of more music and expressing that in a better way. And one of the things that Thaniel is there to do with Maury is kind of temper him and be another moral compass and say, well, is this really the best thing that you could be doing? You realise you are insane. Why are you doing all this?
You mention that Thaniel is a musician and you bring in the real life character of Arthur Sullivan, half of Gilbert and Sullivan. And that's quite emblematic of the way you write. The book is full of historical references. And I get the impression that you really have done your research.
I absolutely have, and I get very cross with people who assume that I have not and that it's all fantasy. So thank you very much. You're going to be treated to a righteous historical rant now. Actually, most of the events that take place in the book are historical. So obviously, at no point was there an epidemic of ghosts through Tokyo, but the politics that the plot sits in, the landscape, the socioeconomic circumstances, those are all real. So there's actually quite a lot of real figures in this book. Thaniel and Maury are fictional, but some of the other characters are very, very real. So, for example, Maury's friend, the Prime Minister of Japan, this insane man called Kiyotaka Kuroda, he was real. He was crazy in real life. He probably killed his wife. His favourite hobby was declaring war on Korea. He was a really interesting person to try and research. There are other real figures in this book too, like Aranori Mori, who's the Minister for Education and who in 1870 actually advocated for the complete romanization of Japanese so that foreigners and children would find it easier to learn. So it is full of real historical keystones. And I think actually that's a really important thing for me when I write, because I'm not clever enough to write full-on fantasy. I don't have the imagination for it. So I find it really necessary to rest the fantastical elements on things that I have researched to death.
And actually, the elements of fantasy that you do bring into the book are quite scientific as well. This book deals with the power of electricity to, well, conjure the appearance of ghosts, without giving too much of the plot away.
Yeah, well done.
And Kato Mori is a master watchmaker who also makes beautiful clockwork toys, and yet they seem to be imbued with life.
Yes, and so a kind of running joke through the book is that Mori has created a clockwork octopus that is alive, but he insists that it can't be because he made it and he didn't make it alive. But what he's failed to realise is that after a certain point, machines will get a certain amount of sentience if you make them complicated enough. So this is one of the things that Thaniel knows that Mori doesn't. But yes, the main scientific concept all through this is this idea of free electricity, which was very much current in the 1890s when this book is set. And one of the main proponents of this idea was of the infamous Nikola Tesla. Free electricity is when you kind of broadcast electricity in the way that we kind of broadcast Wi-Fi or radio now. So the idea would be that you don't just channel electricity along a wire, but you broadcast it 360 degrees all the time. And this is how Tesla managed to do quite amazing stuff, like light up lamps across a room without the aid of electrical wires. And it's one of the ways he lit up light bulbs in the town that he was running his experiment in, unwired to anything. You could pick up a light bulb, hold it, and as long as you were standing on the ground, there was enough free electricity just around to light up the light bulb. This is a real experiment, and you can see images of him doing it. The downside of this experiment is that it's incredibly dangerous. I got really into it when I was researching. I asked one of my friends who is a physicist. So I went, so why did this not take off? And he went, because you would burn down every building within the radius of the electricity. Because, of course, that much energy just floating around is very bad. It would heat up everything. It would heat up doorknobs, door hinges. You wouldn't be able to wear metal. You wouldn't be able to wear rings. The static electricity would be everywhere. It would be hellish. So I was reading Nikola Tesla's work, which is so fascinating, and just marvelling over it. And actually, one of the things that takes place in the book is that a sort of very secretive scientific body builds a very strange tower on the mountainside at Mount Fuji. And this generates an awful lot of electricity and just broadcasts it free over the east side of Japan. And it's based on a real thing that Tesla tried to do. There was a place called Wardenclyffe Tower that he built in the States, and it was designed to do this. Fortunately, it never really got off the ground, or he would have burned down a lot of stuff. But it was all based on real things and real ideas that people had at the time.
Which must have seemed like magic to the less scientifically literate population of the time.
Yes, I think so. One of the things that I've really noticed in researching this period is that science and what we would now consider to be magic really went hand in hand, and there was not a very clear difference between the way that people viewed the two of them. And this links into other things in the book as well. So Maury is clairvoyant. He can remember the future. But this was part of scientific thinking at the time. If you were a relatively scientifically literate person in the 1890s, probably you would believe that clairvoyance was possible, because it absolutely tallied with scientific theory at the time. This comes up in the first book as well, but there was this notion of the luminiferous ether. And of course, scientists always disagreed about everything, but one of the things that most people agreed on was the existence of this thing. And the luminiferous ether is supposed to be a sort of very fine, subtle medium in the air that conducted light, hence luminiferous, luminic, light, ferrous, bearing. It's since been disproven. Actually, Einstein disproved it, but he disproved it very quietly because his tutor really believed in it. But the most extraordinary thing about this theorized substance at the time was that it would have permeated everything. So it was so fine that it permeated deep space, the human brain, everything. But what it meant for ordinary life, ordinary people in the 19th century, was that there was a scientific explanation for the idea that human thought could travel outside of the human cranium, or that the human soul could travel outside of the human cranium. So this idea of clairvoyance and seance, it didn't just pop up from nowhere in the 19th century. I think we see such a vogue of it because this theory of the luminiferous ether was really prevalent at this point. So science was backing up all the things that spiritualists were saying.
Something else that really comes through the book is just what a turning point the world was, both in terms of scientific discovery, but also in terms of geopolitics. And Japan is teetering, and the other great powers, Russia, France, Britain, are itching to get involved for their own strategic gains.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think Japan was in an extraordinary situation in the later half of the 19th century because it was an incredibly rich country, unbelievable wealth. But Japan had just emerged in 1859 from a very long period of their borders being completely closed to foreigners. You've probably heard of this. But all throughout the previous 200 years, it was very, very illegal, really, for foreigners to go to Japan. There was a small island off the south coast where you could go to trade, but Westerners, foreigners were really not a thing in mainland Japan until it was forced to open after the Americans bombed Kagoshima in 1859. When they did open, what they found was that they were in an incredibly scary situation in that they were a vastly wealthy country, but technologically speaking, to their horror, discovered that they were rather behind the large empires like Russia and Britain, not to mention other huge entities like the Dutch East India Company, the East India Company. So they realized that they had to develop very, very fast. Incredibly, they did. They had a series of very long-sighted governments, and they came up with a series of national slogans, and one of them is great. It was catch up, overtake. And that was a specific reference to the West. Consecutive governments in Japan realized that the only way they were going to survive was to import as many Western ideas as they could and improve on them before they got invaded. But this period that Pepper Harrow takes place in, the 1890s, they were still just teetering on the edge of not quite having caught up yet. They'd bought warships, they'd imported different army styles, schooling had been modernized. It was absolutely incredible. But there was pushback within Japan because, of course, that eroded traditional values. There was pushback from the outside world because it wasn't quite happening fast enough. So in 1890, the whole future of Japan could have been very, very different.
I can hear the fascination and passion in your voice for this era of history. Where did that come from?
It's very boring, actually. I think I was just one of those kids who was a semi-shutaway. I just watched a lot of anime when I was about 12 and 13. And one of the things that I really used to notice, like I still remember this quite clearly, firstly, that Japanese is an incredibly beautiful language and that it's always translated very badly into English, or it was in those days. But secondly, that Japanese storytelling kind of works a little bit differently to Western storytelling. And this is, of course, true of all of Asia. So China and Korea, they have very different storytelling structures to they do in the West. And this really fascinated me. And I just started reading more and more. By the time I was an undergraduate, I was doing English literature, but I was starting to read Japanese poetry as well, haiku in Japanese, which is doable, by the way, even if you don't speak Japanese, because they're very short. You can decipher that with a dictionary quite quickly. They are incredibly elegant and very, very clever. So I think it was just this slow thing that built up over a long time. And of course, for all this time, I was still watching anime. I was still watching insane Japanese science fiction movies. I always loved it. Mori was always Japanese. And then eventually I applied for a wonderful scholarship that was run by a foundation called Daiwa. And every year they send out people for about 2 years to Tokyo to learn Japanese. And I got it and I did it. So I did used to live there.
So you immersed yourself in Japanese culture for, was it 18 months, I think I read?
Yeah, it was 18 months. It was a year of language school in Tokyo, taught by a teacher who had never heard of Scotland, which I thought was fantastic. And then a month up in Hokkaido, which is where some of the action in Pepper Harrow takes place. And then 6 months working at Waseda University, teaching creative writing in English, I should hasten to add.
I was reading your website and you say that being an author and being able to apply for scholarships like this is a wonderful privilege. You've also travelled to Peru to research your second novel that we also have in the RNIB library, The Bedlam Stacks, which is about the sourcing of quinine from South America, which is a fascinating subject in itself.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. It can easily become quite dry. But yeah, I did go to Peru. I get restless. And one of the things particularly with this book was that I'd written about an expedition that goes to Peru for months, but I had never been. And my publicist said, "Don't you think you'd better get over there?" And I said, "I have no money." And she said, "I don't care." So I went. Very, very fortunately on a grant from the Society of Authors. Peru is a remarkable place, really, really remarkable. And one of the things that I did was that I recreated my own Japanese scholarship in Lima. I signed up to language school for 3 months because you can learn Spanish in 3 months, whereas it takes like 7 years to learn Japanese properly. And then I did part of the route that the expedition did. I traveled down to Lake Titicaca, which is one of the stops in the Bedlam Stacks. I spoke to lots and lots of people. I followed Quechua people around, asking them about indigenous ideas of time. They all got very annoyed with me, but they were very nice about it.
Merrick Tremaine, the hero of the Bedlam Stacks, also makes brief appearances in Pepper Harrow. Rather like David Mitchell, you like to have your characters step from one novel to another.
Yeah, they do just tend to glance in, and really they're just kind of Easter eggs, and they're a reminder that this does all happen in the same world and that these people are linked up. At the very end of Pepper Harrow, Merrick is mentioned, partly because Thaniel doesn't believe that Mori has a friend who would just vanish to Peru for years. He thinks that Mori is lying to him and has made it up, and he's quite surprised to find that this is a real person.
So where are you going to be taking us next? Is there going to be another Kato Murray novel, or is Mr. Tremaine going to be heading somewhere else on another mission?
So actually, the next thing that's going to be published, which should be around May next year, is absolutely brand new. It's not related to anything I've done before. It's a book called The Kingdoms, and it's an alternate history about what might have happened in England if we had lost the Napoleonic Wars. It follows a man called Joe, who believes that he's grown up in slavery, as increasingly peculiar things happen to him. He has what he thinks is epilepsy. He starts seeing things, and particularly he starts seeing a man who's waiting for him on the seashore. And this becomes more and more powerful. And eventually he ends up in Scotland because he maintains the engines of lighthouses. So he gets interesting call outs and he ends up kidnapped and put on a ship. And before very long, he realizes that he's fallen about 95 years into the past and that he's got to a point where England has just lost the Battle of Trafalgar.
Well, like all three of your books so far, it sounds like a terrific and fascinating setup, and I can't wait to read it. In the meantime, we can enjoy all three of your books as audiobooks. Both The Watchmaker of Filigree Street and The Bedlam Stacks are already in the RNIB library, and I know that The Lost Future of Pepper Harrow is heading there soon. They're superbly narrated, the two Kato Mori books by Thomas Judd. Did you have anything to do with the selection of him as a narrator?
No, I didn't. And I kind of desperately want to take credit for him because he's so wonderful, but it didn't involve me at all. This is not of my doing. This is my brilliant agency who were responsible for that.
Are you a big fan of audiobooks yourself?
I think they're fantastic. I'm going to voice a really unpopular bias here in that I hate being read to. And I absolutely can't understand why I hate being read to, but I just can't stand it. But everyone else I know tells me that this is a ridiculous thing to think. And any normal person would absolutely enjoy being read to. My brother lives off audiobooks. I think I really need to get over it, don't you?
Maybe you should start listening to your own.
I couldn't possibly do that. That's the worst and most vain thing I've ever heard. Like, who listens to their own audiobook? What are you talking about?
Well, only in so much as they're beautifully narrated, and at least you'd be familiar with the story and could listen to the voice.
Yes, that's entirely reasonable, but I tell you now, it's not going to happen because I'd just be too embarrassed to listen to it.
Now, your day job, when you're not busily creating wonderful stories, is to teach creative writing at Bath Spa University. What do you look for in a creative writing student?
Sheer blind enthusiasm, because I think that that's actually the most important thing. Writing is a craft in exactly the same way that carpentry is, or even painting. It is a thing that you can teach someone to do. What you can't necessarily teach someone is the endless patience required to learn it. I think there are a lot of misconceptions around writing. One is that you're either born a genius or you should give up. This couldn't be further from the truth. It's a craft. You need to put in your 10,000 hours in order to become an expert at it. And that time can really drag on. The reason that most people who want to be writers never get published and never finish a novel is that it takes ages to write a novel, particularly your first novel. So the most important thing for me in students, particularly undergrads, is just that absolute passion and that willingness to pour time into it, because it is one of those things you have to pour time into.
And you have to be happy in the world that you create in the book.
Yeah, you do. It's interesting because quite a lot of people write things that really frustrate them and that they hate very early on in their writing careers. But this is exactly the same as somebody who is learning to play the piano and who really likes composition, but they just can't quite get that composition right to begin with because the enthusiasm is there, but the skill isn't quite there yet in order to pull off what it is that they're thinking of. So there is a lot of frustration in the early parts of writing, but if somebody adores the idea that they have, it doesn't matter to me whether they can quite get that on the page yet or not. My job is to make sure that they can and that the idea matches what gets onto the page. The main thing is to not lose heart.
Well, I think that's fantastic advice, and presumably read other people's work all the time as well.
Yes, absolutely. The best writers I know, all of the mega successful people, they are so steeped in reading and literature that they could teach it at Oxford University.
Well, I urge people to read your books, which are not just entertaining, but also very educational. So, Natasha Pulley, thank you so much for introducing me and the Read On listeners to Kato Mori and his latest adventure, The Lost Future of Pepper Harrow.
Thank you very much.
The Lost Future of Pepper Harrow is out now in print, ebook, and audio, and should soon be joining Natasha's first two novels, The Watchmaker of Filigree Street and The Bedlam Stacks, in the RNIB Talking Books Library. And Natasha will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. Now with news about this year's Silip Carnegie Medal, here's Red Seal in a Cupboard.
The Silip Carnegie Medal is the world's oldest prize for children's literature, and past winners include some of the most loved children's authors ever. And now they've been joined by Anthony McGowan for his novel Lark. Tony, many congratulations.
Thank you, Red. I can't deny it's one of the greatest moments of my life, so thank you for that.
How did you hear? Because obviously lockdown has rather changed things.
Yes, it was all a bit strange. I mean, you always hear apparently a few weeks in advance of the actual big ceremony. So I found out on what is now the modern way of communicating on a Zoom meeting with my publisher. And actually, I had a vague idea that it might be good news when I saw my old friend at the publisher, Barrington Stoke, Jane Walker. I noticed that her eyes were were slightly liquefying, and I realised it might be good news at that moment. That was a very, very, very pleasant thing to find out.
Now, you mentioned your publisher, Barrington Stoke, and they specialise in producing books for reluctant readers or readers who have problems like dyslexia and therefore want a great story but maybe a little bit shorter and with simpler language than some of the other books on the market. They really do have a commitment to making books fully accessible, don't they?
They do, and it's not just in terms of the actual text that you produce. Also, the whole look and feel of the books are specially designed to help those reluctant readers, and in particular those with dyslexia. So the font is very easy to read. Even the colour of the paper has been specially designed to help the text stand out. And so you get all those kind of technical features to help those reluctant readers. But also I think what they do really well is to make these look like really beautiful objects. So there's no sense in which these dyslexic kids are getting a second class product. They just look so beautiful. The design is so well thought out. So I'm really proud to write for such a great publisher.
And they're certainly not getting any less of a story. Lark, like the three books that have preceded it, is a thumpingly good and very gripping story that explores all the emotions that a teenager can feel. For those who haven't yet come across Lark, could you give us a little bit of an insight into the story?
Yeah, sure. The actual story of Lark itself is quite simple and direct. Two teenage heroes, Nicky and Kenny, are out for a walk on the North Yorkshire moors. And where they live down the valleys, the weather's just a bit drizzly, but it's fine. But when they hit those high moors, it turns very nasty. They get stuck in a blizzard and things sort of spiral down from there. That they're with their little Jack Russell Terrier, Tina. And it turns into a life and death struggle. It's a kind of survival adventure, I suppose. So that story all takes place in one day, really. But I suppose it gains resonance by the backstory, which is that the two brothers come from a very, very troubled family background. Their mother's left home, their father couldn't cope at the beginning of the series. And also the older brother, Kenny, has moderate learning difficulties. And his younger brother, Nicky, is his carer. And so their relationship has been absolutely central throughout the four books in the series. And it's now put to the ultimate test in what genuinely is a struggle for life and death at the end.
I heard the news that Lark had won this year's Silip Carnegie Medal during our celebration of Carers Week on RNIB Connect Radio. And I thought, what a wonderful, happy coincidence that a book that recognises the hard work and love that so many carers put into looking after family members and friends is recognised.
Oh, absolutely. I suppose that what I wanted to get across it in the four books, and also in a particular sharp form in Lark, is that although Nicky is the carer for his older brother, it's almost a relationship of codependency. They love each other very much, and he's come to depend on Kenny as much as Kenny depends on him. I also wanted to show Kenny as a fully rounded character in his own right, that he has his own character narrative arc, his own character develops over the books. And that one of the things that Nicky has to learn towards the end is that Kenny is his own person and he's going to go off into the world on his own at one point. But so, yes, those caring relationships are central to the book. But also, I wanted to get across how complex and interesting they are.
The last time we spoke, you said that this was the last book in the series. It was the fourth in the trilogy, I think you told me.
Yes.
Are there any more plans for a fifth book in the series?
I don't think I can, because it so brings the whole story to an end. I don't want to give too much away, because you know, it is quite a short and concise book, and almost anything I say will turn into a spoiler alert. But right at the end, it takes the story forward into their adulthood and explains the origins of the text, why Nicky is telling these stories. And I just don't think I can squeeze another one in there. When I put my final full stop, you know, I did become quite emotional, because I got to know these characters so well and I really cared for them. It was hard to leave them behind. And I suppose another thing I really wanted to do in this book was, although it is a story with elements of tragedy and sadness in it, I wanted to give all of the characters a fulfilled life. I felt a real responsibility to that. I had to, although the, as I say, the sadness, I didn't want there to be tragedy really. So I think I did tie up neatly all those loose ends, and there's nothing more left to say about their story.
I suppose you raised a glass to both brothers when you got the news.
More than a glass, Red, I have to say. It's a pretty terrible hangover the next day. I hope at some point there'll be a bigger booze up.
And what are you working on at the moment?
I don't know about you, Red, but I find it very hard to do anything creative in the lockdown. It's just something about that general heaviness and that mood of not knowing. So creative work's been quite hard for me. But I was luckily able to do a little kind of edit. I'd almost finished a book, which will come out next year. Actually, the title changed towards the end. It was originally called Stinky Mog, but it's now called I Am the Minotaur. And it's set in a world not dissimilar from Nicky and Kenny's, but it's a totally separate story. That's another quite short book, which is a collaboration between Barrett and Stoke and the Oxford University Press. So that's all done and dusted, comes out next year. I'm also halfway through a book. I might well have mentioned it last time. I've been halfway through it for a long time now. A book which is about the interaction of feral dogs and wolves and other wild animals in the wilderness area around Chernobyl. So that's my kind of big ongoing project.
Plenty to keep you busy. And in the meantime, yes, we've got the first three books in Nicky and Kenny's story, Brock, Pike and Rook, which are all narrated by you, all in the RNIB library, and Lark, which is narrated by Fraser Hadfield.
Oh, you've got a proper actor to do it. That's excellent. You know, I genuinely can't wait to hear it.
As we walked our way through the stories, the landscape changed. It was almost as if the world was changing to fit in with the stories. First, a few bushes and tiny tree saplings began to line the banks of the stream. Then the banks on both sides rose up, so that the stream was below us, except it was even more like a river now. Then trees grew around and over us, and that was good because we were more sheltered from the snow and the wind. The trees were mainly bare, but if you looked closely you could see buds beginning to emerge, tight fists of life waiting to open out into a green hand. Not so good was the fact it was getting dark. We hadn't seen the sun all day, just rainy greyness turning into snowy greyness. So it wasn't as if you could see the sun sinking, or even sense it. It was just like one of those dimmer switches, with someone gradually turning the lights down. "Why aren't we there yet?" Kenny asked. "Won't be long. The river will cross the path in a few minutes, and before you know it, it'll be chip-butty time." Just then the bank we were on took a turn upwards, and the stream fell even further below. The sound of the water deepened into a roar, and big rocks barged out from the surface. There were no still parts of the river, and everything was white. We walked on. I looked across at the other bank and saw that the stream had carved a canyon and the walls were shining rock. The drop down to the water now was almost as tall as the side of a house. It would have been dangerous, but someone had to put up a wooden fence to stop you falling over the edge. The snow had stopped, or rather turned back to wet sleet, and the trees were thicker here, so there wasn't much snow lying on the ground. I took Tina out of my jacket and put her down. She looked happy to be among the trees and cocked her leg a few times. I was suddenly starving. And then I remembered that we didn't have to find the village to have something to eat. "Kenny," I said, "the sarnies." "What?" Kenny asked. "Oh yeah, and there's Pop left."
Fraser Hadfield narrating Lark, by Sillett Carnegie Medal winner Anthony McGowan. Tony, thank you once again, and many, many congratulations. And I'll look forward to inviting you back onto the show next year.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Red. Thank you so much. I am delighted for me and for my great publisher. So thank you.
This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come, a great Books of Your Life from Natasha Pulley. But now...
Fans of a good, twisting crime thriller may well know the name Katerina Diamond. She's the author of the D.S. Imogen Gray series of novels, the sixth of which, Woman in the Water, has just gone into the RNIB Talking Books Library. She joined me over Zoom to tell me more about the book and the series. Kat, welcome to Read On.
Really nice to speak to you guys.
So, for fans of crime fiction who haven't yet come across D.S. Imogen Gray, can you introduce us to her, her partner and her beat, please?
So, Imogen Gray is late 20s D.S. in Exeter Police Department, and she works with D.S. Adrian Miles.
And they're in the murder squad, aren't they, investigating some pretty unpleasant crimes. And Woman in the Water begins with, well, a woman in the water.
That's right. They find a woman in the water. They think she's dead, but she's not, but she won't tell them who she is, and so they have to investigate and find out whether she just can't remember or whether she's keeping secrets.
And rather chillingly, she says, I might be alive, but I might as well be dead.
Yeah, she's in a pretty horrible situation that she doesn't want to go back to.
D.S. Adrian Miles soaked in the sunrise as he drove home along Glasshouse Lane after a few days away with his partner, D.S. Imogen Gray, far from local prying eyes. They had barely noticed the relationship creeping up on them. They had gone from strangers to good friends within weeks of meeting each other. Then things had blossomed and grown between them until the chemistry was undeniable. They were still in the early stages, not enough to announce anything, not enough to tell anyone. He smiled to himself as he thought about the last few days, weeks, months. Every moment was a countdown to the next time they could be alone together. It was always so quiet on these suburban streets, especially at this time in the morning, and the calming effect of the River X seemed to ebb into these surrounding neighbourhoods. Something about living near water makes people generally more relaxed. He must have driven past at least 10 people out for a morning stroll with their dogs. Maybe getting a dog would be a good way to get out of the house more. These days, he mostly just drove anywhere rather than walk. More often than not, as he drove, he found himself thinking about Imogen and missing her when she wasn't beside him in any capacity. These feelings had crept up on him, and he found himself completely losing himself to her, as though he had no choice in the matter. He'd also sometimes find himself smiling without realising. Was this happiness?
Stevie Lacey narrating Woman in the Water, written by my guest, Katerina Diamond. This is the sixth book in the series that began with The Teacher. And again, you are investigating crimes that aren't always written about. There's a dark side to your crime thrillers.
Yeah, I like to explore things that are less explored, partly because I like to think about the impacts of certain crimes on society, and also because you don't want to do what everyone else is doing. There's a lot of similar stories out there, and I wanted to approach the crimes from a different viewpoint almost.
You are famous for the twisting, turning, and sometimes shocking revelations that come through your plots.
Yeah, when I'm writing, I try to think about what I enjoy as a reader, and I like to be shocked and upset. So I try to do that to my readers as well.
Do you ever find that you're writing something that you can't see all the way through to its conclusion? Do you ever back off?
When I was writing The Teacher, I had like a picture on my wall and it said, life begins at the end of your comfort zone. And I try to remember that when I'm writing something that I find difficult. and that it's important to push yourself past where you feel comfortable in order to find new things about yourself.
Is that why you write about Exeter, which I believe is not the city that you live in? You live on the other side of the country in Kent, I think.
That's right. I do live in Kent, but I grew up around Exeter. And I think because I was younger there, I spent a lot more time exploring. And I feel like I know the place probably better than I know where I live now, even though I've lived here for longer. I think when you're younger, you do more exploring.
And is Exeter ideally suited to be the centre of crimes, as Oxford seems to have become?
Well, no, Exeter's quite a nice place. Nothing terrible really happens, but obviously there are cases, but it's certainly not the hotbed of crime that I have made it out to be.
Now, many crime novelists have a pet policeman or former policeman who they check the police procedurals next to. Do you have somebody in the local police force there who you can double check things with?
No, I don't. I really don't like asking people to help me. And so I just try and research.
And were there crime writers who influenced you in the direction that you took?
I think when I was younger, I used to read a lot of Agatha Christie, and I obviously don't write anything remotely like Agatha Christie now. She's hugely talented, but she writes sort of a comfy crime, cosy crime, I think they call it. But when I got older, I sort of stumbled upon Karen Slaughter and Mark Bingham's books, and I felt hugely inspired by them. Although I never actually set out to be a crime writer, it sort of happened by accident.
Oh, yes. What was the accident that started you off?
I was writing a story, quite a bleak romance, and then I felt like it was missing something. And so I put some murder in it, and then I felt like you can't have a murder without police. And so I put some police in it, and that became The Teacher, which was my first novel. But when I started it out, it really wasn't meant to be a police procedural. It just became one. And then I felt like I'd found my genre.
That's interesting, because I do feel that the working relationship that Imogen and Adrian have together as policemen sometimes feels rather like a marriage.
I was really conscious that I wanted to make them good friends, and I also wanted a bit of conflict in there, because I think most good friendships have a little conflict in them anyway. As soon as I created them, I knew that I was going to write more with them. And so I wanted them to have these personalities that were naturally meshed together.
And they challenge each other through the books, but are absolutely there for each other come what may.
Yes, and that was what I wanted. I didn't want the big romance, and I didn't want the complete antagonistic relationship.
And now that Woman in the Water has been published and gone into the RNIB library, are you working on book number 7?
I'm actually working on a separate book that is not part of my series. I've got the first of my standalones, and then I've got to write one more, and then I can go back to the series, which I'm very much looking forward to doing, because I miss Adrian and Imogen quite a bit.
Have they become like friends to you?
Well, you wouldn't do that to your friends, but yeah, they are sort of part of my overall thinking most of the time. It's like, what would Adrian do in this situation? What would Imogen do in this situation? Usually, because I watch a lot of TV crime dramas, and I always try to imagine which cases would get the most reaction out of them, and what I would like to do with them next.
Now, all 6 books have been bought vividly to life by narrator Stevie Lacey, who does a terrific job. Did you have anything to do in the selection of her?
I was given a sample of her work beforehand, and I liked her, so I said, yeah, she sounds good. But I have actually listened to all the books, because sometimes when you're writing a series, you forget things that you've written in the past. But then I actually met Stevie Lacey at a thing, and she was great, and we had a chat, and it was really nice to meet the person behind the voice.
Are you a fan of audiobooks yourself?
I try to be. I find it all very much depends on the narrator for me. If I like a narrator, then I will seek out everything they do and listen to that. But if I struggle with the narrator, then I can't get through the book.
And you must be delighted that because of HarperCollins' relationship with RNIB, all your books have gone straight into the RNIB library and so are accessible to people who are print disabled.
I think that's absolutely fantastic, and I think it should be mandatory for all books.
Amen to that. Well, Katerina Diamond, thank you so much for taking us down to Exeter and introducing us to Imogen Gray and Adrian Miles' Beat. And I hope you'll come back onto the show to talk about your standalone novel in a couple of months' time.
I would love to do that. Thank you ever so much.
Thanks again to Katerina Diamond. Woman in the Water is out now and joins the other five books in the DS Imogen Gray series in the RNIB Library. For more information, visit rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. Now it's back to Natasha Pulley for the books of her life. Natasha, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, absolutely. It made me fall in love with reading. I didn't understand that being an author was like an actual job that was available to me until I was at least 20. But the book that really stuck with me from when I was quite young, I think I read it about 10, which is probably too young to read it because it is full of sex, but never mind. It was called The Mad Ship by Robin Hobb. And it's this fantastic high fantasy novel about a world in which there is a certain kind of wood that is alive and it's carved into ships. The ships are called live ships and their figureheads speak. And it sounds like a simple idea, but the way that Hobb deals with it, she makes it into a whole world with its own politics, its own socioeconomic concerns. It's incredibly realistic, and everything hinges on the existence of this incredible wood, which is called wizardwood. And I remember reading it and thinking, I have never seen anything like this before. And I'd read lots of fantasy by then, but it was fantasy for kids in that it was reasonably limited. And I just picked it up at my local library. And I read it while I was on the bus on a school trip in year six to the Isle of Wight. And I was just blown over by how brilliant it was. And I've never forgotten it. And it's still on my shelf above my head now.
Back in the monastery, Berendal used to say that one way to disperse fear and create decision was to consider the worst possible outcome of one's actions. After a moment, Wintrow added, Berendal said that if one considered the worst possible outcome and planned how to face it, then he could be decisive when it came time to act. Vivacia glanced back over her shoulder at Wintrow. The boy had been leaning on the bow rail for the better part of the morning, staring out over the choppy water of the channel. The wind had pulled his black hair free of his queue. The ragged remnants of his brown garments looked more like a beggar's rags than a priest's robe. The sentient figurehead had been aware of him, but had chosen to share his silence and mood. There was little to say to each other that they did not both already know. Even now, the boy spoke only to put his own thoughts in order, not to ask any advice of her. She knew that, but still prompted him along. And our worst fear is... Wintrow heaved a heavy sigh. The pirate suffers from a fever that comes and goes. Each time it overpowers him, Kennet emerges from it weaker. The source is obviously the infection in his leg stump. Any animal bite is a dirty wound, but the sea serpent's bite seems unusually poisoned. The festering part must be cut away, and the sooner the better. He is too weak for such a surgery, but I see little prospect that he will grow stronger, so I tell myself I must act swiftly. I also know it is unlikely he will survive my cutting. If he dies, so must my father and I. That was the bargain I struck with him.
Anne Flosnick narrating The Mad Ship by Robin Hobb, which is available from the RNIB Library, as are the rest of the books in the Live Ship Traders series. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
This is probably the most pretentious thing I've ever said, but it really works because this novel is absolutely massive. So you'll always miss bits or your attention will stray and you'll always find new bits if you reread it. But it's The Tale of Genji. And it's just the one that you read if you really love Japan, because it is heavy going, because it is an old, old, old book. It was written in the 11th century by a Japanese noblewoman called Shikibu Murasaki. Amazingly, Murasaki means purple, so she was Lady Purple, which I love. But The Tale of Genji is this enormous tome. We think it's the first novel that was ever written that follows a young man called Prince Genji throughout his royal career at Japan's ancient capital. And it is just incredible. And you can see throughout this novel the seeds of pretty much every genre that is to come in novel writing ever after. Particularly, she's good at stuff that feels gothic. It's full of semi-haunted places and these endless noblewomen who just wait and wait, and frivolous gentlemen and power plays. And it's just absolutely enchanting and magical. Some of the best prose I've ever read is in that novel.
Suzaku worried about his daughter constantly, morning to night. As the year came to a close, his illness worsened, and he would not even come out from behind his blinds. Sometimes malignant spirits afflicted him, but there were also periods when his condition improved. Even with these occasional respites, he was convinced that his death was imminent. Although he had abdicated, those he supported during his reign continued to serve him and take comfort in his warm kindness and splendid appearance, and they grieved with all their hearts that he might soon pass away. Messages of concern from the Rokujo estate followed one after another, and when Suzaku learned that Genji himself planned to call on him, he was pleased and honored. Genji's son, the middle counselor, paid him a visit, and Suzaku summoned him inside the blinds, where they had a close, intimate conversation. "The late emperor, my father, gave me many last instructions when he was near death, and he had special requests regarding both your father and Emperor Reze. However, after I succeeded him to the throne, I found that there were limits to what I could do, and while my personal affection for your father never wavered, a fleeting transgression on his part alienated him from me, though he has given no indication during the intervening years that he holds any lingering grudge. When it comes to one's own position or fortune, there are many examples from the past when even a wise and prudent man loses control of his emotions and, driven to seek revenge, does something twisted and evil. People at the court had such suspicions about your father, wondering when his true feelings would be revealed, but he has endured and kept himself in check."
The Tale of Genji by Murasaki Shikibu, narrated by Brian Nishi, is available commercially.
And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Yes, so I'm going to stick with my fantastical theme. There's a brilliant writer called James Brogdon who writes, I guess, what we would call low fantasy. So it's not completely world built. It's not like Lord of the Rings. It's set in our world, contemporary world, but fantastical things happen within that world. And he wrote the most fantastic novel called Heckler's Children, which is all about what happens when a group of children disappear off a, you know, a fairly normal school walk. But the most extraordinary things happen to these children and happen to the people who are investigating their disappearances. And what they soon realise is that in this fairly ordinary national park, there's a gateway into another world, but it's not a real world. It's like a psychological reflection of all the things that the culture of the place it belongs to hinges on. And it is just the most incredibly well thought out, clever example of how we talk about myths and legends and how they manifest in our minds. And it's kind of got everything, and it's got this wonderful monster figure in it. But the best thing about it for me is that the person who you think is going to sort everything out isn't the person who sorts everything out at all. They become more and more of a problem. I'm being vague because I don't want to give too much away, but it's just one of the best books I've read recently. I so enjoyed it.
It is happening now, as it will go on happening until the end of time. In Sutton Park's main town gate car park, the coach is surrounded by a milling chaos of students hauling rucksacks out of its luggage bay and squabbling over them like hyenas disemboweling a wildebeest. The teachers stand at a safe distance, watching, and Nathan takes advantage of the noise and confusion to sidle up to Sue. She's been deliberately avoiding him since they got on the coach, even though he's the only other person who knows why she's been off sick for the past 2 days, and it worries him that she doesn't seem to want to talk about it. "I don't want to talk about it," she says before he can open his mouth. She looks pale and tired. "I do," he says. "I'll walk with you up to your checkpoint." "No, you bloody won't," she hisses, still without looking at him. "The last thing I need is one of those gossip mongers seeing us together." "Which one's the stuff of the kids?" This produces a wan smile, which he takes as an encouraging sign, even though she turns from him without response and walks away to help two girls disentangle their bags. The students are sorted out and given the obligatory safety briefing on what not to do to the local wildlife and how not to get killed by strangers, and as they split up with their respective leaders, Nathan surveys his own particular party of brave adventurers. He's been given the latecomers and the remnants of other groups that have imploded due to the shifting allegiances of adolescent peer politics. There are four of them, shuffling and grumbling under the weight of their packs. Team Leftover. "Morning, chaps and chapesses," he grins. "Right then, have you got your map and compass?" "Here, Mr. Brooks," bellows Ryan, snatching both from Catherine Scatty Powell.
James Parsons narrating Heckler's Children by James Brogdon, which is available from the RNIB Library.
Natasha Pulley, thank you so much for sharing your obvious passion for reading with Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. You've been so nice to me.
Oh, but we're always nice.
If you want to share the books of your life or ask us about anything that you've heard on Read On, the email address is radio@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. But don't forget to tune in at the same time next week, or you can always download the show as a podcast.
Just search for RNIB Audiobook Show Read On in your favourite podcast app. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you found this.
And if you can, why not rate, review, and leave us 5 stars?
Please do. Hitting like really helps us get the word out about Read On, the audiobook show.
You can find us on Twitter. I'm at RedSail, which is RedSZell.
And I'm at talking_books.
Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.